Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, welcome back. Third hour, we're just going to keep doing this. We're going to keep answering your emails. Or I should say, I'm going to keep answering your emails. If you want to send me an email, just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, click on connect, and then click on send me an email. I look forward to hearing from you. This one comes in from Anonymous, and I can kind of understand why, but this is one of those times where instead of calling in or writing in to say, hey, I took your advice and it worked, here's one that says, I took your advice and it didn't work. At your inspiration, I gave my son The Dogma of Hell at Christmas. This is the book that I've talked about before. It's called The Dogma of Hell, and I told the story about how I had given it to all my family members at Christmas. It was intended for one particular sibling of mine, but I didn't want to just give it to her because then it would be rude, or I thought she might be offended. Turns out she was offended because she knew I was giving it to her specifically, even though I bought like 12 copies and gave them out to all the, you know, the teenage and adult members of my family at Christmas. But in any case, with her, it worked because it got her attention. She wound up coming back to a practice of her faith. She had never left the church, but she was drifting. So here is the response from this listener who says, at your inspiration, I gave my son The Dogma of Hell at Christmas. Well, it blew up in my face. He got angry and said I was being judgmental, condemnatory, and proselytizing. He was disgruntled that I have brought up my grandfather's lack of baptism twice over 3 years. He basically declined to honor God in any way. He did say that he would listen if God wanted to tell him personally that he exists. Otherwise, it's a no-go. I did tell him that no amount of material goods, video games, a new car, or a home will bring him happiness, which can only be found in God. And I did use your counterargument to judgment, asking him to keep an open mind. Since then, he has called once in 4 months and will only send me pictures of my granddaughter if I ask my daughter-in-law, for them. I am complaining about this to God rather than to others, but with all his Catholic school, catechism, and private Catholic high school education tuition, I feel like I need a refund. Where do I go from here? I hear you. I really hear you loud and clear. Now, as for the book, let's start there. I would just say give it some time. How much time? I don't know. Could be months, could be years. It could be many years, but maybe at some point, when his life has reached a critical juncture and he reads that book on hell, it may very well have the kind of effect that you're hoping that it would have had on him earlier. It doesn't always happen that way. So I would just say, give it some time, and maybe down the road, it will be the right time for him to read that book. He'll be in a better frame of mind to read that book. So yeah, I completely understand your frustration that after spending all that money, hard-earned money, I'm sure that you had to scrimp and save to be able to send him to a private Catholic high school, and all the other sacrifices that you made for your son, only to see it go up in smoke because now he's not practicing the faith and he's far from God. And I could understand your frustration entirely, and I could understand why you'd say, I want a refund. Now, I'm certain that the school is not going to give you a refund. Wouldn't that be interesting if Catholic schools had to have a money-back guarantee that if your child winds up leaving the church, winds up leaving faith in God, that they have to refund some portion of what you sent them by way of tuition? That would be interesting. It'll never happen, but wouldn't that be interesting? I wonder if it were to become a rule, if some Catholic schools that are not quite so assiduous in teaching the faith might be more so. One only knows. One only guesses. But in any case, I can understand your frustration. It is difficult, but it's not impossible. So keep things going. Keep the line of communication going. The fact that he's irked and irritated that you gave him that book, in a way, that can be actually a good thing, because at least he's not just passive. There's some sort of, you know, emotional He's alive in a certain sense, meaning that he's it got through to him. If it made him angry, I mean, if he was utterly apathetic, okay, thanks, and then just, you know, fling the book off into a wastebasket, that would be worse than him having a reaction to this. The fact that he had a reaction is, in a certain sense, a good sign. That means he still has a spiritual pulse because it bothered him. And who cares if he thinks that you're being judgmental or condemnatory? Obviously, you're going to be kinder about it than I am right now. But my advice would be just stay the course. Stay the course. Slow and steady as she goes. You've tried this. It didn't work. It may work later. But in the meantime, if it didn't work, just keep going steadily. And when the opportunity is right, you ask him a question. I find that it's more advantageous if you ask somebody a question rather than tell him something. People don't like to be told things as much as they like to be asked their opinion on things. And everybody has an opinion on just about anything. So maybe if in future conversations you talk to him about what is it that is blocking him from being close to God? Is it that he doesn't believe in God anymore? I mean, there are ways to talk about that. So I understand where you're coming from, and I can easily empathize with your frustration, but don't throw in the towel. Just keep things going. Be patient. Keep praying for him and plan on a miracle. That's what I would do. It may be late in the game, but God is in the habit of doing such things. Thanks for the email. This comes in from Chris. He says, Patrick, love your show, but I'm not able to listen every day. So if my question has been dealt with on the air, my apologies. I enjoy World War II history. When reading about the disposition of the Reich's leadership, I think he's referring to the Third Reich in Germany, their leadership remnants after the war, it is sometimes mentioned that the Vatican played an active role in the ratline escape of wanted Nazis from the European theater to other parts of the world, including Juan Perón's Argentina. Is this true? And if so, how did it come about? Thank you, Chris. Well, Chris, yeah, it is true, generally speaking. It's an unfortunate fact that there were some in the Catholic Church, including at higher levels of the hierarchy, who were sympathetic to Hitler. It's hard to imagine that being the case, but there were some who were sympathetic. I'd say the vast majority of Catholic bishops, certainly Pope Pius XII, he was not at all sympathetic to Hitler or Hitler's project, and yet there were some who were. Keep in mind that during World War II, you had many German bishops who were stuck. Some of them were adamantly opposed to what Hitler was doing, and they said so, and in some cases they were killed for their trouble. In some cases, they just simply kept their heads down and tried to minister to the flock during the war. And in other cases, there were some who were actually sympathetic. They had sympathies for what Hitler was doing, and maybe not so much in terms of what he was doing to the Jews and others, but they thought that he was a strong leader and he was tapping into national pride and he was pulling the Germans back together again after their disastrous defeat a generation earlier in World War I. So to the extent that there were some Catholic figures who assisted Nazis in escaping, I think it's a matter of established historical fact. There's nothing we can do about it. Looking back on it, we can say it shouldn't have happened, but it did happen. So maybe the best thing to do if you want to get some really specific scholarship on the topic would be to pick up a couple of books by Ron Richlack, R-Y-C-H-L-A-C-K. He's a professor, he's a law professor at University of Mississippi, and he is a scholar of that era. He's a scholar of, well, what specifically did Pope Pius XII do, for example, to thwart as best he could Hitler's aims? There's a false narrative out and about which holds that Pope Pius XII actually was complicit with Hitler insofar as he agreed with Hitler's final solution, and he did some things behind the scenes to help Hitler. That's utterly not true, but some people still believe that. And so Ron Richlack has done a great deal of good scholarship in demonstrating not just what Pope Pius XII did, but also he takes into account what was actually going on in Europe during the aftermath of World War II, and how was it that the Nazis, in some cases, were assisted by some Catholic figures. And that's where I would go if you want to do some further reading on that. Thanks for that email. I appreciate it very much. This one, short and sweet, comes in from Raphael. It says, what happens to those who do not know the faith and or may not be as intelligent enough to understand the faith? Not that they are mentally impaired, but they may not be as wise to understand. This question is with respect at the time of judgment. I would say that God would be merciful and understanding. What do you think? Well, Raphael, I agree with you. God is certainly merciful and understanding. He doesn't expect the impossible from you. And so in any given case, if it was impossible because of somebody's limited knowledge or maybe they did have some kind of mental impairment, all the more reason to say that God has mercy on somebody like that. But rather, it's people who don't have those kinds of limitations who are going to be held to a stricter judgment, because if you have sufficient reason, if you are sufficiently intelligent and you have access to information, then your excuse for not knowing becomes that much smaller. You know, with more information and more knowledge comes more responsibility. So I think in your case, the simple answer, well, I should say in regard to your question, the simple answer is there are indeed some people who are simple, maybe not simple-minded, but they're simple, and they're not given to intellectual pursuits, and they don't read maybe, and they don't really pursue those kinds of questions about the big picture issues. God gives everybody sufficient grace for their exact situation. There is enough grace that God will give to each human person that they can be saved. And he works with our deficiencies. So what we can say is in those cases, in a way known only to God, there may be somebody who, through no fault of his own, never really kind of figured it out. It never really dawned on him. He or she never really understood. And if it's truly not his own fault, we believe as Catholics that the Lord has mercy on that person. And it's up to him ultimately to determine where that person will go, heaven or hell. But if the person is genuinely seeking to know the truth, even if in a limited way because of, you know, diminished intellect or something, God takes all that into account. This is why we pray, pray, pray. We tell the truth in love. We speak the truth in love. We help people to see who Jesus Christ is, what he did, the church he established, but we leave everything in God's hands. We do the best we can, and we leave everything in God's hands. Great question. Thank you. This one comes in from Rosie. Hello, Mr. Madrid. You don't have to be so formal, Rosie. You can call me Patrick. She says, I was hoping you might have a recommendation for a safe news source for a fifth grade Catholic school classroom. Currently, they are using Time for Kids, which has some problematic transgender ideology stories. I very much value your opinion, and I know that you have a plethora of resources. I don't have a plethora of pinatas, but I do have a plethora of resources. Thanks for all you do, and thanks for your time, Rosie. Okay, Rosie, I would recommend that you get in touch with Holy Heroes. It's an organization that produces some really high-quality resources for kids of all ages, but certainly for that age group. And since they're in a Catholic school, one of the ideal things for them would be to learn about the saints, learn about Jesus, learn about virtue, learn about the Mass and the sacraments. And so they have resources that include very professionally and well-produced audio CDs. They have some DVDs. They have a lot of things available. And that would be a good place to browse around and see about maybe bringing in some of those resources. Their website is holyheroes.com. I have no connection with them. I know the people involved, but I don't have any, you know, financial benefit to me or anything like that. Nancy and I, we have purchased over the years lots of their materials for our grandchildren. And even when our youngest children were young enough, we got a few things for them. But it's primarily all for our grandchildren. So we have an interest in what they do, and we also have experience with the good things that come from their resources. So check them out. It's holyheroes.com. I also am very partial to the Baltimore Catechism, as you know. And so if you're interested in getting that, it's published by the Catholic Book Publishing Company. And if you want to look on my Twitter feed, at Patrick Madrid, just go into the search bar on Twitter and type in at Patrick Madrid Baltimore Catechism, and it'll pull it up. And you can see not only a picture of the front cover, it's a gray cover, it's volume 2. It has Jesus on the front cover with the gospel that says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. I would certainly recommend that book for, let's say, 10 and up, 12 and up, something like that. It's good for adults, too. It's a great refresher course. And there's even a link there if you're interested in pursuing it with I think it's going to the publisher's website, if I'm not mistaken. By the way, I do really recommend, whenever possible, to patronize your local Catholic bookstore first. If you can get these books from them, that's so much the better, because we want to support the good work that they're doing. If you're not able to do that, or maybe if there's no Catholic bookstore near where you are, you can always go online and get them. That's always a backup. But try to support your local Catholic bookstore first. All right, this one comes in from Chris, who says, "Hi, Patrick. I'm looking for a show to watch. Many people recommend Ozarks or Ozark. Looks like there is a bit of nudity and sexual content. Have you watched this series? Could I still take communion if I watch the show and not overtly sin because of the sexual content in the show? Thanks, Chris." All right, Chris, here's my take on this issue. First of all, to answer your question, yes, I did watch, I think, one episode of Ozark, and I might have tried into the second episode, and I just dropped it because even though it's well acted and it's dramatic, there was enough about it that I found irksome. I don't remember seeing any nudity, but then again, I only watched I watched an episode or so. So I never got to the point where any of those things were actually on my screen, but I could easily imagine what you're talking about. So your questions are, can you still take communion if you were to watch this and not overtly sin because of the sexual content in the show? I don't know what you mean by that you would not overtly sin. Does that mean that, now how am I going to say this? Let's put it this way. If you're watching a movie or a TV show or something like that, and it arouses lust in you because of what you're seeing, and that's not difficult, especially, you know, the younger you are, the more likely it is to have an effect like that on you. There are, shall we say, two ways that you could commit a sin involving that. One would be an action, let's say, that would be brought about as a result of what you're seeing and what you're thinking. And that would, maybe that's what you're referring to. I don't know, but that certainly would be a serious sin. But it's really no less serious. It's serious in a different kind of way. Even if you didn't do that, if you were to, in your mind, be fantasizing and consenting, I don't mean to stammer. I'm not nervous. Don't worry. But if you were to consent in your mind and then relish and enjoy and, you know, ogle what you're seeing on the screen, that would certainly be a serious sin. No doubt about it. So I think the best rule of thumb is if this is something that's going to have those kinds of things, just avoid it. Just avoid it. Now, my wife and I, when we watch a series or we watch a movie that we maybe don't know anything about, we always, you know, almost always, it typically is how it works out anyway, is that we'll watch these things together and I'll have the remote in my hand with my finger on the fast forward button. And every so often, you know, we're mature people. We understand what these things are all about. And you know, we've been around the block a few times, so we know what to look for. And if something like that comes on the screen, I just simply fast forward it. Now, sometimes it's unsalvageable, and maybe there's a movie or a series, and we just look at each other and say, this is hopeless, we're not going to bother with it. We just turn it off, or we go to something else. Sometimes it might be a little blip, it's there and gone, and it doesn't come back. In which case, for people who are old enough and mature enough and have sufficient self-control and you have a remote control with a fast forward button on it, you know, then you use your value judgment. Is this something that we can benefit from watching this movie if we just skip over the bad part or the bad parts? Sometimes that's a way you can do it. But honestly, the younger you are, and I would say this would have been true for me when I was a younger man, I don't think I could have done that as, let's say, a 20-year-old, 25-year-old, 30-year-old, maybe even 35-years-old, maybe even 40-years-old. You know, when you're younger and you're not as experienced in such matters, it may be more dangerous for you and maybe much more dangerous to the point where you should just say, I'm not going to have anything to do with this because I know how weak I am. And if I'm not careful, I may wind up falling into some of these sins. So you have to use discretion, and you also have to be careful, and you also have to know yourself, know your weaknesses. It's one thing to say, well, I'll look away, but if you find that you're not really looking away, you know, then I think you should say, this is not for me, and just just say no. I mean, it's so much easier to say no. And I guarantee you that when you're on your deathbed, you're not going to regret that you didn't watch more TV, that you didn't watch more series. So that's my take on the Ozark thing. That's my take on the nudity and sexual content thing. But one last thing I'll mention to you is that, oddly enough, there is a series. There are several I can mention, but I'll just mention one that may seem very counterintuitive to you. It certainly was to me when we first started looking at it. And that is, well, you know what that is? That's a series that I'm not going to tell you the name of right now. I'm going to wait until I come back from this break. How's that for a teaser? It's a series that Nancy and I found very, very interesting. And there's not a single thing wrong with it. You may say, oh, that's impossible. Well, when I come back from this quick timeout, I'll tell you what it is. And it's out there. You can watch it if you're interested. And I'll bet you've never heard of it. And even when I tell you the name of it, you'll say, well, that doesn't ring any bells. So I'll tell you what that is and why Nancy and I found it gripping even, and why I would recommend it to anybody. And I'll tell you all that on the other side of this quick timeout. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
All right, we are back. And Cyrus, I get it. I see what you're doing. And I interpret by the music that you're playing that you assumed that I would...
Am I right?
Well, just for those who are tuning in right now, I said that I was going to identify the name of a series that I really found riveting. Nancy and I both did, and we really enjoyed it. It doesn't have any moral problems or, you know, anything like that. And you're guessing I was going to say The Waltons, right?
Everybody is guessing The Waltons.
That's where you're wrong, my friend. That's where you're wrong. And it is not The Waltons. But, you know, it could easily have been The Waltons, but it's not. That's not what I had in mind. So just a plug for The Waltons, I do say, if you're interested in a, you know, a series that is really good, you don't have to worry about the kids watching it, I would definitely check that out. But that wasn't it. So here's what it is. You ready? You might want to write this down.
I'm ready. I can't believe you're talking about something other than The Waltons that's on that's on television. This is a first.
Okay. I bet you're not even ready for this. Stissel.
What? I'm going to need you to spell that for me.
Stissel. S-H-T-I-S-E-L. Stissel. So you're saying, all right, what is it? What is Stissel all about? Okay, when I tell you this, you're going to laugh, but I'm telling you, it's about ultra-Orthodox Jews living in Jerusalem. It was shot maybe about 10 years ago or so, 8-10 years ago. And they're like a bunch of rabbis. And they're ultra Orthodox, and it's not a documentary.
Did Father Simon turn you on to this show?
No. I bet he doesn't even know anything about it, but he'd love it. So check this out. Okay, Stissel, and that by the name is the it's the last name of this family, and in particular, it has to do with the son, who's an ultra Orthodox rabbi. He's sort of the main character, the main person. But there are all kinds of people involved here. It's not a documentary. This is a drama. So it's acted with actors and the whole thing. And it is unbelievably good. I'm telling you, first of all, there's no bad words. There's no, you know, immoral scenes. There's nothing like that. And it's all about the trials and travails of these Jewish people. Now, the thing is, the younger guy, the son, he looks to be like maybe he's in his late 20s, perhaps. He's unmarried, handsome, not movie star handsome, but, you know, he's a handsome looking fellow, and he's not married. So there's some like love interest aspects of it. You see a lot about the inner workings of not only ultra-Orthodox Jewish life, but also, you know, the religious aspect of things. And it's a basic human drama. and it's really good. And when Nancy and I first started watching, I said, hey, why don't we check this out? She says, oh, no, come on, that looks deadly dull. Come on, ultra-Orthodox Judaism, you know, Jews living in Jerusalem, what on earth would we have in common with that?
Grab the popcorn.
Let's give it a try, shall we? And she's like, well, okay. Well, after the first episode, I was like, okay, let's watch another one. Okay, let's watch another one. Let's watch another one. And it has three seasons, and you just need to see it from the very beginning. Start at the beginning.
So are there any superheroes?
There are no car chases.
Explosions?
There are no explosions. There's no superheroes. There's no talking animals.
How do you spell this? One more time.
I wish I made some sort of royalty off this. I really do. Shtisel. S-H-T-I-S-E-L. And I know you think I'm crazy, but I can guarantee you, I would bet you money that if you sat down and you started watching this, you'd have to give it an episode or two just to kind of...
Fair enough.
Okay. After about two episodes, you're going to say, all right, I'm hooked. I feel like I'm overselling it now, and I don't mean to do that, but... All right. This is a long and complicated email, and I'm not even sure I'm entirely able to follow all of it, but I'm going to give it a shot. We'll see what happens here. Actually, this particular one here is a little too long, so I'm going to put that off to the side. By the way, that reminds me, everybody... When you want to send me an email, please don't make it a 5-page email. Please, if you can, don't even make it like a whole page of an email. Just give it to me short and sweet as best you can, because then it's much more likely that I'll be able to read it on the air. So I've got an email here that I'm not going to read right now. And this email is just really long. So I can't read it. It's just too long. But if you want to send me one, I'd love to read it on the air. Just make it short and sweet. Unlike my answers. So, hey, speaking of Judaism, this one comes in from Patricia. She says, Patrick, I'm hearing you on YouTube and on Christian TV about the Hebrew Roots movement. Christian fundamentalists are practicing the Jewish holidays and running around in prayer shawls, praying in Hebrew. Now, I guess it makes them feel closer to Jesus, but I fear they're going to question if Jesus is the Messiah. While it is good to know about our Jewish roots, but not at the expense of believing in Jesus. I listened to some of these rabbis on YouTube, one in particular who goes out of his way to trash Jesus and Christianity in general. I just want to make sure you're aware of this, and if you are not already aware, how do we explain to friends who do watch this how dangerous it is? All right, well, it can be dangerous to somebody's faith if they're credulous, and if they're listening to, let's say, a rabbi on YouTube, maybe he's very persuasive, and maybe he seems to make sense. There may be some sort of superficial logic to what he's saying. So naturally, if a Catholic is not strong in his faith, if he doesn't know what he really believes and why, it could easily be a stumbling block that could lead to people leaving the church. So, I mean, these things happen, and I wouldn't underestimate it, especially if it's somebody who is not strong in the faith. So what can you do about it? Well, first thing is be very familiar with who Jesus Christ is. Read the Gospels. Read the epistles of the New Testament. Read St. Paul's epistle to the Galatians, in which he rebukes the Judaizers, those who said back in those days that if you wanted to be a Christian, you actually had to be Jewish first. So if you were a man, you had to be circumcised. You had to keep kosher. You had to fulfill these ritual prescriptions in the ceremonial law of Moses. And none of that's true. But for some odd reason, some people find that very alluring and very appealing. And maybe they think that they're like being fully Christian by adopting some of these Jewish requirements. And St. Paul says, no, you don't have to do that. In fact, you shouldn't do that, because that's regressing backward. And all of those good things in Judaism, all those things were fulfilled in Jesus. Now, here's something to remember. The Jewish religion of today is not the same as it was in the time of Christ, for this reason, that in the time of Christ, Judaism was a religion of the temple. They had synagogues because, you know, Jews are scattered all over the world, but even in the land of Israel, there were plenty of Jews who simply didn't have the wherewithal to go up to Jerusalem and be in the temple and pray there and to offer sacrifice. You know, they were encouraged to go if at all possible, say for Passover, if that were possible. It wasn't always possible, though. But the essence of the Jewish religion in those days, and that was true up until AD 70 when the temple was destroyed by the Romans, The essence of the Jewish religion at the time of Christ was animal sacrifice. Animal sacrifice. They taught the law and the prophets in the synagogues. So the rabbis would teach and they would discourse, but the religion itself was predicated upon animal sacrifice. Now, that ended when the temple was destroyed. So when the Romans came in and they said, okay, this is something up with which we will not put because of all the rebellions and things, and they destroyed the city and they destroyed the temple. And remember that about 40 years earlier, Jesus had said, see this temple? See this? You tear it down, and in 3 days I will rebuild it. And they didn't understand that he was referring to his body. And in subsequent conversations with them, Jesus also said, there's coming a time, and some of you are going to live to see it, when not a stone is going to be left standing on top of another stone. And they were in the temple complex. It was massive. And it was imposing and formidable, and it was impossible to imagine that those heavy stones might be dislodged from one another. But that's exactly what the Romans did. They absolutely razed this place to the ground and killed countless thousands of Jews in the process. It was very brutal. And those that escaped up to Masada, that mountaintop fortress, the Romans said, yeah, that's fine, whatever. And you have all these thousands of Jews up there, or at least 1,000 of them anyway, and they thought they were going to get away from the Romans because they were out of reach. So what did the Romans do? They just simply spent the next year or two building this gigantic ramp all the way up to the top of Masada, and then they went in there, and then they killed everybody who didn't first kill themselves. But in any case, the point is that there are many arguments that are raised by rabbis then and now, ancient times and modern times, and they raise arguments against Jesus. So let me give you a couple of resources that will help you. The first one is a book by Eitan Bar. So his first name is Eitan, E-I-T-A-N, and we would say that in English is Ethan. And Bar, I don't know if this is a pen name or not, because Bar means son of. And so, you know, instead of Eitan Bar Jonah or Eitan Bar Yehuda, it just says Eitan Bar. So I don't know whether it's a pen name or not. But in any case, he is a Protestant Christian, and he has compiled in this book called Refuting Rabbinic Objections to Christianity and Messianic Prophecies, he has put together a response to the kinds of arguments that the rabbis use against Christians. Well, Jesus couldn't have been the Messiah for this reason or for that reason. So especially with regard to the Old Testament prophecies that point to Jesus as being the Messiah, this book will help you, if you ever get in that situation, to know how to respond to those kinds of rabbinic arguments. And keep in mind, the rabbis, they knew that, and we're talking about, let's say, rabbis in the Middle Ages, and even before that, they knew that Jesus was very attractive to many Jews because the Jews are historically a people who have been waiting for their Messiah. And so when Jews, not to mention others, would come into contact with the prophecies in the Old Testament and begin to put two and two together, and they realize, well, Jesus fits these prophecies, they recognize that sometimes, and maybe even often in some cases, the Jews were leaving and becoming Christian. They didn't want that. So they would make up stories about Jesus being a criminal or Jesus being a golem. A golem is, some people say golem, they're just, I suppose, different ways to say it. It's like a zombie, like a dead man who can fly around and do magical things, but he's actually dead, but he does things that living people can do and more. So they'd make up these scurrilous stories in the Talmud. The Talmud is a series of tractates, rabbinic commentaries on the scriptures, but also rabbinic folklore and things. And usually when something pertains to Jesus, or really all the ones that I've ever seen, in the Talmud, they're very derogatory about Jesus and about Our Lady. So this is nothing new, but that book that I just mentioned, Refuting Rabbinic Objections to Christianity and Messianic Prophecies, that will help you. Now, another book is written by someone I know personally. His name is Marty Barrick. He wrote a book called Second Exodus. He also has a website by the same name, secondexodus.com, I think it is. And he was an Orthodox Jew, and he converted to the Catholic Church. And, of course, his family did not understand that. They didn't like it. And so he wound up writing this book as a compilation of all of his responses to the types of Jewish arguments that he was getting from his family members. So that's another thing. If you're interested in that, you can read up on that, and I think you'll find that very helpful. Okay, here's another one. I'm just trying to keep an eye on the clock. I know we've got the break coming. Talk about short and sweet. This is about as short and as sweet as it gets. This is from Anthony. He says, I have to ask again, Patrick, why do you hate clowns? What?
Yeah, Patrick, why do you hate clowns so much?
Do I wear that on my sleeve or something? First of all, he says, I have to ask again. Anthony, when have you ever asked me this question before? I don't remember ever being asked this question. So I don't hate clowns. I'm not afraid of clowns.
You know what? It's because we'll say like we're living in a clown world, in a derogatory or a negative term. I bet that's what he's talking about.
You know, I bet you're right about that. It didn't even occur to me. See, I thought he might be, like referring to the infamous clown masses, where, and this is just a horror story, but the 70s and 80s, and maybe they're still happening somewhere. I hope they're not, but where, the priest would dress up as a clown and people would dress up as clowns and they'd go to the mass and they'd juggle and they'd have balloons and it was all a perversion of the mass. But, I was at one of those, or at least at the very beginning of one. I think I told the story, Cyrus. Nancy and I were, before we were married, we were college students and we were on a retreat at a university up in Northern California. And it was Sunday, as I recall, and we were going to go to Mass, and the Mass that was available to us was available that afternoon. So we went in and we're waiting for Mass to start. And a bunch of clowns came in full clown outfit. And they had the big shoes and the nose and the wigs and the makeup and all that. And they weren't like passing through. They were there. They gathered around the altar. And then before you know it, there's music and there's juggling. And I just about vomited when I saw the priest was dressed as a clown with his vestments on, but he had clown clothes and a clown nose. And they start walking up to the altar and there's a clown sitting on the altar swinging his legs. And Nancy and I just said, that's it, we're out of here. So we got up and we left. And as I remember, we didn't get to Mass that Sunday, but that was the only Mass we could go to, and we didn't have a car to get to another Mass, so I think God understood. But I did see that with my own eyes. I've never forgotten it.
Whoa, I've never heard this story. That's crazy.
It's terrible, yeah.
But it's terrible. This isn't like an ordained priest. They've just taken over a church?
No, it was an actual priest.
Oh.
Yeah. So if people ever say, well, did those clown masses ever really happen? Unfortunately, they did. And we saw the beginning of one, but it was so stomach churning that we couldn't stand it. And we got out of there. So anyway, if that's not what he meant, then maybe you're right. Maybe he means, because I call it clown world. But I don't have anything against clowns per se. I don't like being in a world that's run by clowns. That much I'm against. But it seems like that's what's going on. So one last question. I know we've got to take a break, but I'm going to squeeze this one in. This one comes in from Kurt. He says, Patrick, once the soul is separated from the body after death and the body is cremated, is that a problem for the body to be connected to the soul in heaven? The answer is no. So think of it this way, Kurt. God can create things out of nothing, and he did with the universe. So directly he created that out of nothing. And he can create other things out of nothing if he chooses to do so. So for God, who is all-powerful, the fact that the body is cremated and completely atomized and maybe just not even existent anymore, it doesn't pose any problem whatsoever to God to bring that very same body back and unite it at the end with the soul. And that's what will happen in the general resurrection. We'll all receive our bodies back. And for those who are going to heaven, it will be a super enhanced body. It'll still be your body. It'll be the body that you have right now, but it will be super enhanced and glorified. And I shudder to imagine what the analog to that will be for those who are damned. I don't even want to think about that. But we will all, both those in hell and those in heaven, will experience eternity in a bodily way, not just spiritually, but also bodily. That's going to be amazing. All right, well, I do have to take a time out. We'll do that now. We'll come right back to more of your emails. Please stay right there.
Oh. 5, 6, 7.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
Well, we're moving and grooving with some emails today. If you would like to send me one, just go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Click on connect and then click on send Patrick an email. I look forward to seeing what you send me. This one comes in from, I think I'm going to make this one, no, I don't need to make this one anonymous. Okay, this one comes in from Anna. Patrick, what advice can I give my friend whose husband has proven to be cheating, and it seems like it has been going on for several months before she knew about it? She let Christmas and birthdays pass so her daughters wouldn't have a bad memory about it during those family events. We've been praying for them for a long time, for her husband's conversion, but he still keeps on seeing this other woman. My friend did all that she can to be intimate and caring to her husband, but he refuses her. So this rejection and his cheating made her feel that her hubby already loves another woman more than her. They are married in the Catholic Church, and it should have been 25 years already coming up soon. But she's now convinced that she should divorce him when she confronts him about this ongoing cheating. And this she was advised to do by her lawyer. I don't know what to tell my friend. Well, what a tragic situation, especially after so many years of marriage, that he's going haywire like this. My strong advice would be for you to advise her not to pursue a divorce until every last possible option can be tried, because you want to try and save this marriage. Even though he's a scoundrel, you should try to save this marriage. And I can't imagine the suffering that she's going through. How terrible. So several things come to mind. Number one, if I were her, I would get in touch with Mary's Advocates. It's a group started by a woman whose husband basically abandoned her, and he walked out on their marriage. And so she not only was hurt, but she's also, you know, not going to, what's the line from the movie? You know, I'm angry and I'm not going to take it anymore. And words to that effect, I suppose. But she wanted to put all of this energy to good use, so she started this organization called Mary's Advocates. Their website is marysadvocates.org and is dedicated to defending marriage, and in particular against what's called unilateral no-fault divorce, which is where one or the other spouse can just simply walk out of a marriage and leave the other spouse stranded, emotionally speaking, at the very least. So I would encourage her to get in touch with the people at Mary's Advocates. Send them an email. They will answer. They will respond. They have articles. They have other resources, including videos and interviews and things. And this would be helpful for her to know what her rights are, especially as a Catholic. Now, in terms of how you're going to salvage the situation, if it can be salvaged, of course, he's got to get his mind right on this issue and stop doing what he's doing. So that's going to require a lot of prayer and maybe intervention. You know, maybe her father can sit down with this guy and set him straight. He has standing as the father-in-law, so maybe that's possible. Maybe her brother. If she's not able to get his attention, maybe somebody in the family might be able to do that. It's worth a try. Maybe she should give him that book on hell, The Dogma of Hell. Hey, by the way, you know, since you're on your way to hell by what you're doing, maybe you might want to read up on what it's going to be like when you get there. With obviously the subtext being you don't want to go there if you can avoid it, and you can avoid it if you stop doing this nonsense. So that's another thought. You can see that book if you go to, and I'm not trying to sell you a book. It's not even me selling it. It's just a link so you can see it. Go get it at your local Catholic bookstore. It's called The Dogma of Hell. You can see that by going to relevantradio.com/Patrick and click on links, and you'll see it in there. Well, the link to it anyway. Go, if he's willing to go on a Retrovi weekend. HelpOurMarriage.org is their website. Go on a Retrovi weekend. See, he needs to, as the saying goes, he needs to come to Jesus before anything else. He needs to repent of this and stop doing it. It's a serious injury to the marriage, but it's not fatal. It doesn't have to be fatal. And if he's willing to stop what he's doing and knock it off and be really sorry for his sins and go to confession and get right with God and get back on track and do what he can to try to earn his wife's trust again, he can do that. But he has to do that. And if he's not willing to do that, it's like the Hindenburg. And she's a passenger. And obviously that's a tragedy all the way around, certainly for the children. The book Primal Loss by Layla Miller is a good example of that. It's a book that's just testimonies of children whose parents got divorced. Now, they're writing as adults, but they describe the terrible devastation that divorce visits upon the children, invariably. Even if it's a so-called amicable, friendly divorce, it still visits tremendous destruction on the children, in some cases in ways that last well into adulthood, if not until their own deaths. So parents be warned that if you're getting a divorce, that you're actually dropping a nuclear weapon on your family and it's going to hurt those kids. So I would get that book. Maybe she can give him a copy of that book. Hey, look what you're doing to our children by doing what you're doing. Not to mention the sins that you're committing. Things come to my mind, and I do hope that something there will be helpful. Maybe the retrovi weekend will be just what the doctor ordered. This email comes in from Mary, who says, "Hi, Patrick, I'm a revert 4 years now after being 50 years estranged from the Catholic Church." She says, "I attend an FSSP parish. I take advantage of the local diocesan parish, which is closer. They have an adoration chapel, and I usually go to Mass there occasionally when I can't make the commute to the FSSP parish. FSSP stands for Priestly Fraternity of St. Peter. That's the Latin acronym." She says, "I noticed the setup there for funerals includes unfurling two huge permanently mounted screens on either side of the crucifix." She's referring to the sanctuary. This is at the diocesan parish. She says, "This is for slide presentations, and my guess is that there are indeed eulogies to go with the PowerPoint presentations. One of the priests has interrupted Mass more than once to have us sing happy birthday to an altar server or make comments about himself, such as a trip he was organizing. The sanctuary at that parish strikes me as more of a community center rather than a place of prayer and sanctuary. My own experience is that at my own mother's funeral Mass last year, which was arranged at the Catholic cemetery in their chapel and celebrated by a priest the cemetery had procured, also included a eulogy. Why is our own church and diocese in the dark about the rubrics for proper Christian burial liturgy, Mary?" Well, Mary, I don't think that people are in the dark. I think in some cases, like the ones you described, they just flout the church's requirement on this issue. Why they do it, I don't know. I mean, if I were a priest, and I would know from seminary training, etc., that certain things are required to be done and other things are not permitted to be done, I would try my best to do what the church wants me to do. I mean, why be a priest after all? Why even do that? Why even give your life to the priesthood if you're not going to do what the church wants you to do? We don't need freelancers. So in the bigger picture of things, it's a relatively small infringement, but it still is an infringement. It's an infraction. The church says no eulogies during the Mass of Christian burial. You can have eulogy the night before, at the rosary, at the wake. You can have eulogy after Mass if you want. That's fine. You know, the church has nothing against eulogies. And as human beings, we know that we want to say something respectful and maybe a happy memory about the person who died and honor their memory. That's all good, and the church supports that, just not during Mass. So as for the big screen TVs and all the other stuff, that kind of gimmicky stuff, it's just not necessary. The Mass is by far more than self-sufficient in providing you and me what we need when we go to Mass because of what it is. It's making us truly present at the Last Supper and at Calvary as Jesus is dying on the cross for our sins, and in the heavenly sanctuary where Jesus, our high priest, is eternally offering his once-for-all spotless sacrifice of himself, the Lamb of God, to the Father for our sins for all eternity. And the Mass is where we become present, mystically speaking, at all of those things simultaneously. So we don't need big screens to enhance it. It doesn't need to be enhanced. But people do need to know why they're there, and maybe as they have a deepening understanding of that, all the gimmicks start to fall away. We don't need gimmicks. Jesus didn't use gimmicks. And when you go to Mass, focus on what you're there to do, which is to worship God in spirit and in truth. and to be united with Jesus and his sacrifice for you and for me, that is more than sufficient. I hope that's helpful to you. Well, I think I have reached the end of the line. In fact, we got some music coming, so I'm going to have to wrap it up for today, but I do look forward to being with you again tomorrow. Same Pat time, same Pat channel. And I think maybe we'll take a breather from the emails. We'll get back to our normal phone calls. But in any case, thanks for listening today. Please pray for me. I'll pray for you. God bless you.